So you like to look at people's heads, do you?
What
Or
is
is it the
that?
soul? Is it the soul that you look into?
Mean with counseling?
Yeah.
I love having conversations.
Ah, yeah.
I think you can relate to that, right?
Kinda. At least that's what I, that's how I play on TV.
Yeah, I love talking to people about stuff. Obviously counseling, it's more one-sided, right? Sometimes it's more listening and more the other person talking. I mean, I think ideally you don't want to be talking too much if you're the therapist, but so I do have sessions where it's a very dynamic discussion and conversation. And those are the ones that I enjoy the most for sure.
How did you get into that? Was it accident or fate or a burning desire inside?
Yeah, it was kind of a circuitous route. I studied criminology, and after that, I was thinking about doing policing, and then that kind of didn't pan out. And so then I had thought about counseling and social work before, but I just remember thinking about it and just thinking, like, sitting in a room talking to someone sounds really boring and lame. So,
Yeah.
and I also was kind of scared of burnout because I know like social work, any kind of social services has high burnout. So, but then after I was a youth worker for a while and really enjoyed that. I really enjoyed just one-to-one work, like meeting with these, young men and trying to help them out. And then after that, that confirmed, okay, I think I could do this. And then went back to do my master's of social work. And then, yeah, I really enjoy it now. So I'm glad I did.
Masters of Social Work. How was that?
It was not good. I mean, it started out good. It was a small cohort of 13 people. I did foundations, which means most, at least in BC and Canada, most people have to do like an undergraduate in social work and then a master's. And so it's like a 4-year undergraduate and then a 1-year master's. But there's a found thing called a foundation program where if you already have a bachelor's degree and you have at least 2 years of experience in social service work, then you could just do a 2 years master's. So the first year is kind of like a condensed, bachelor of social work. And so the first year was 13 people and everyone was super lovely. And yeah, it started off with great high hopes, but it kind of devolved over the course of 2 years. Yeah, it was kind of unfortunate actually, but I did learn a lot, not like from the content of the curriculum, but from that experience. And
So what did deteriorated over time? Was it the content of the curriculum or was it the climate of the cohort?
it was a climate of the cohort. Like, yeah, we started out, everyone was super gung-ho, super happy, super connected. There was just some conflict between like me and another classmate and also that classmate, and like she was a little bit confrontational with the teachers. And so it just made it unsafe to talk about things. And then there was another classmate who also had an issue with one of the teachers and it became a big thing. And so there was just, yeah, it just created awkwardness, and particularly for me, and that between like how I felt with that other student, like being around them, which is ironic because they were probably one of my favorite people in the program, like initially, and then ended up being like really, really uncomfortable being around them. And
Because
so,
of their relationship to authority or how they went about exerting their, well, will on others.
yeah, I don't know, like they're really passionate and they're really, strong in their beliefs, which is great. But I think it was, they're just like very condescending and very sarcastic to anyone who disagreed with them. So if there was like, there's a cohort of 13 people, so, and a 3-hour seminar or something, right? So a lot of it is discussion. In fact, there's not that much lecture, right? Maybe like a 40-minute lecture, and then the rest is discussion. So you're obviously asking a lot of questions, but when someone had a different belief to her or a different stance, she would just kind of like ask rhetorical questions in a very condescending, sarcastic way. I was very passive aggressive. Or sometimes she would just call out the teachers. Like one time the teacher was like talking about the theories. It was different theories on groups, like working with groups in social work. And she called them out. She's like, all of these theorists are like white people. Like, where is the theorists from different cultural perspectives? And the teacher himself, you know, it's not like he was even white. He was from Colombia. And he was like, well, you know, I'd be happy to share those, but like, this is what we have. This is the theories that exist, right? These are the like, you know, so he's like, if you have those, then I'm, you know, I'd be happy to look at them. But so that kind of thing, right? Just to sort of like questioning or criticizing, but not offering anything like, you know, substantial. And then there could be like, not always, but sometimes people would jump into it. And like, even I did at one occasion, to my shame, earlier on, before I, you know, started changing some of my views on things. Most of the, like, it was kind of split. Like, most of the class, maybe half the class, like, didn't really like what she was saying and doing. Others maybe tacitly supported her, but wouldn't overtly. And I was probably the only person who spoke directly against her. And sometimes after class, people would say, like, you know, like, I'm glad you said that. Or I, you know, I'm, I agree with what you said, but not during class, just after class, right? So, because they didn't want to be embroiled in any, you know, conflict or,
Yeah.
yeah.
How did your positions or point of view change?
Well, I was struggling with a lot of guilt, white guilt. I took this course called
White guilt.
yeah.
So hold on. So there's this thing called guilt. It comes in different shades now. Is that?
Well, feeling guilty about being white, I guess. I guess you could
Oh,
call that white
okay.
guilt, right? Or about my
You
heritage.
believe yourself to be white, then?
I don't really like that term, but for the sake of simplicity, you know, if you call a European white,
Yeah.
then I guess so, yeah.
So that's where your ancestry is from?
Yeah, I'm a mix of European, like Irish, English, Scottish, and Italian.
Yeah.
And one course in particular brought up these feelings. It wasn't actually, I had a course on critical race theory. It wasn't that course. It was a course on Indigenous relations. And even prior to that course, I knew quite a bit about the Indigenous community. I worked for an organization that was working with Indigenous youth, and I have family members who are Indigenous. So it wasn't anything new.
To
Like, I know,
Canada.
yeah. So I know a lot about the topic, but there was an assignment where you had to bring something. It was kind of like show and tell. You had to bring something from your cultural heritage to class and then talk about it and how that thing might get in the way of working with Indigenous people. So it kind of like, it didn't overtly say that those things were bad, but it sort of invited you to reflect negatively on your own heritage, I think. I don't know if that was the point of it. That was just how I, and when people shared, there was a lot of kind of like cultural self-flagellation. It was really kind of gross. But so for me, anyways, I had all these feelings. And so I just Googled the term white guilt. And this book popped up, White Guilt by Shelby Steele, who is a black conservative. And anyways, I read the book and it exposed me to a lot of conservative ideas that, in a way where I was more open to it, because I've always been more left-leaning in my life. And I always kind of thought conservative people were either like had a lack of compassion or were just uninformed, right? So kind of, you know, I guess I never really took their view seriously or investigated them, right? And then I also went, you know, throughout high school and university, I was never really exposed to them in my classes. So all my teachers and professors were more left-leaning. My parents are more left-leaning. My family's more left-leaning. So I just
Your
never
country's
really,
more left-leaning, just to.
yeah, I'm in Vancouver, right? Like they call it the left coast for a reason. But so I was exposed to it. And then once I started like agreeing with a lot of these things, I just, you know, started reading a lot of other books on different topics. So that was like kind of like a conservative take on race relations. And so then I read conservative books on different topics to see, okay, you know, what other things might I have been wrong about, or have I have I might have been, if I had heard the other argument, might agree more with that other argument, but just because it was never presented to me, I never really thought about it, right? So
What happened to your white guilt?
it's gone, honestly. But creepily and weirdly, I do sometimes experience some, I hate to use the term, but internalized racism. I guess, like, you know, I, for example, I was looking on a church website in the States. I'm Christian, and I was looking on their website, and all of their staff were white, and they just seemed very, like, you know, kind of traditional. And I just, like, I had this thought of, like, oh, like, why are they all white? And then I was like, why? Like, why does it matter? Like, who cares if they're all white? What if they're all black? Like, I wouldn't care if they're all black. So why do I care that they're all white? So that kind of bothered me. But at least I'm aware of it now. I think a lot of people, they have those feelings, but they don't question them or,
Yeah, the
you know.
lowest tier or one of the lower levels of what is called woke is just a basic pattern recognition and problemization through pattern recognition. And once you get that pattern recognition going on, once you start to see race and start to count the beans, so to speak, then it just kind of steps out. And then it's always stepping out at you or popping out at you. It's like, oh, there's this thing, there's that person with that race, this person with that race, this person with that race. Where's the diversity? Where's the diversity? And I think that the media in general does a lot of work to platform or center, so-called, a diversity of skin cast. And then when, let's just say, like, middle white bread, North Americans, or just kind of in white communities, they look at their white community and they don't see the representation that they're given through the media, right? And since the 2020, and I guess over the last 10 years, it's been ramping up more and more. Where, I mean, I know there was a report a couple months ago that all new hires in Fortune 5 companies are all not white. Basically, the entire culture is, or at least the elite culture is, implementing some sort of racial, I guess, sifting mechanism, this reverse racism, or this racism that is intended to reverse, some sort of marginal or some sort of like normalization that white people do this thing. I'm just trying to process what you're processing because I see it too. Like, oh, look at all these white people, or look at all these black people, or look at why would they put a black person in this role or a white person in that role? And then you can do that too with sex too. Like, why are all the men on TV like they're all schlubs or pathetic, and the women are all heroes or misunderstood kind of thing? You start to see, this reversal. And then I don't know what you're supposed to do with that information other than just recognize that you're making a pattern recognition.
Yeah, I think the one of the underlying assumptions behind the problematization of, like, a, you know, a lot of one group is that is a sort of belief that unless you're part of a group, you can't understand their experience. So, for example, if you know only have males in leadership, then by definition, that company is not going to be hospitable to women because they don't have any women speaking into their leadership. So they can't understand women unless they have a woman on the board, right? And to some extent, I think there's a kernel of truth in it, which is, as we know, right? Like, half truths are always the best lies. So there is a truth that there is a lack of experiential knowledge of being a woman for you know an all male leadership team or something like that. But that doesn't mean that they can't listen to women and implement, like, thoughts of women, right? It doesn't mean you have to have a woman in leadership in order to have a healthy company for women, right? That's the non sequitur.
In the case of counseling specifically, and I guess social work more broadly, and even pastoral work, any sort of humanitarian type work, there is a reality to cultural differences and to being able to see the world through other people's eyes. Now, I take umbrage with the critical social justice standpoint epistemology where they say if you are not this, then you can't know what that is. Because I think that is it's really insulting to human beings. Like human beings can't understand human beings. Like I don't have an imagination. Like if I read a book about like I don't know, like some bushman, like I would never be able to understand his thoughts and feelings as he's going through this adventure with a tiger or whatever. Like we watched The Gods Must Be Crazy not too long ago, and like I can understand like the differences, and that's where a lot of fun and humor comes from, these differences. So these differences are real. I think that the critical social justice way of thinking about them is crude and base, and also even psychologically harmful, if not criminal, to a certain degree. But what are your thoughts on when you, as a counselor, are working with a woman, or you're working with an indigenous person, or somebody from a different culture? Like, to what degree does that cultural competency, so-called, come into play and serve you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I work with a lot of indigenous people, and I there's a there's insurance they can get, like the session's covered through the provincial government. So I did a training to like be a provider through there so that they could have it covered. And I had to do a training, but like that word cultural competency is like not even in vogue anymore. It's like, oh, like we can, you can't be culturally competent. So you just have to be curious. You just have to always be asking questions because you'll never be competent. But as we know with, it's never good enough, right? It always has to be something more, right? There's always something more progressive than what was 2 seconds ago, the standard. But to answer your question about how do I, connect with people of different cultures, or how do I engage with them if I have a different cultural lens, and make sure that I'm not imposing my own beliefs or biases onto them because of my, what I grew up with or what I, was normative for me. I think this sounds very overly simplistic, but I think asking questions and really kind of trying to learn about their culture, right? Because even Indigenous people, right? Like they have within BC, there's like I don't know how many different groups, but probably over 50 groupings within BC that are distinct. And post contact, like everything just became lumped into Indigenous, right? Because their population was decimated, and they needed to, for political reasons, identify as, pan-Indigenous, essentially, right? Like even in Vancouver area, North Vancouver, there's a Squamish Nation, and I always thought the Squamish Nation was like one nation, but there was many nations around that area, but they're just, around the turn of the century, there was like 10 people from each group, so they just amalgamated into the Squamish Nation, right? But going back to your question, yeah, asking people questions about what their culture is like, and it sounds simple, but I think it's as simple as that, really, right? Just not, and being willing to do things different. I think being flexible is really important. I find, especially with my Indigenous clients, especially the ones who aren't urban, right? The ones who grew up on the reservation, so they're more culturally different. This is another interesting question. There's a lot of cultural similarities between rural Indigenous people and rural white people, more so than rural Indigenous people, or sorry, rural urban people and rural, like urban and rural divide is sometimes more salient than the cultural divide. But being asking questions and being flexible to how they want to do things, because my modality is CBT. It's very, cognitive behavioral. It's very logical. And kind of like there's homework, but maybe with Indigenous people, they're a lot more relational. So maybe the sessions I do with them, I have to be more flexible. And I'm eclectic, so I don't just use CBT. I use different approaches, so I'm able to do that, and it's fine. I think most counselors are willing to be, but I feel like that's one of my strengths as a counselor, is that I'm quite flexible to people wanting to work in a different way, as long as I can adapt that to how I see. My own lens. I can't completely abandon my expertise or what I've learned, right? But being willing to maybe like be more open-handed with the way you do things, right? Because that is, I think, what was a lot of the harm done to Indigenous people, was saying like our ways are better than your ways. Let's impose our ways upon you and not learn from any of your ways. And now it's the reverse. our ways are terrible and bad because we're colonialists and we need to indigenize everything. Well, that doesn't make any sense. It's just a reverse of what we did before, right?
What do you mean they're more relational? Or can be?
I think it's like, I guess it's sort of, any cultural that's closer to being like a traditional culture or like that's not Western individual. So this isn't like specific to indigenous people, but I think it's any culture that's more traditional, more collectivist. They just value relationships and like who you know is very important, right? So like if you're in a community, you can't just like go and like meet people with, you have to like meet with like the people in the village who have, some leadership or authority, and then like it's by relationship that you're sort of like vouched for and can gain access to the community. So I've never really done that community work on reserve. So that hasn't really applied to me. It's been more in an urban context. But even then, like I worked in a transition house with a lot of indigenous people in there, and I could see that dynamic going on, right? Like if there were certain people in the building who, if you knew them and had a relationship with them, that would enable me to be able to work, or it made other people able to trust me more, I guess, in that I knew that person or that person vouched for me. So, I mean, that's not inherently indigenous or anything. Obviously, like, we have that within every culture, but I guess there's just more of a less of an emphasis on the professionalization, right? The counseling is very professionalized. There's certain things you have to follow and like being willing to be flexible with that, I guess, right?
What is that? What's that? How long have you been practicing counseling?
Since 2019.
Okay, so well, that's 4 years now. And I guess, is there any specific way in which being in contact with another culture shows you something about your culture that you hadn't seen before? Or allows you to kind of, I don't think it's bad to criticize your culture. Like there's aspects of whiteness. I'm not guilty about them, but aspects of whiteness, like it'd be nice if we could dance better, stuff like that. There's a kind of a bureaucraticness to the systems that we've created that is kind of stodgy. And I understand, but then also when fellow whites try to go on, try to romanticize like a more traditional or native or indigenous way of being, that's kind of they do it whitely, oddly enough. Like, oh, you're doing that whitely now, Does that make any sense? Like, there is
That
kind of
makes
like this
total
thing,
sense, right? It makes total sense, right? Like let's center or celebrate or put forward indigenous culture in a way that also aligns with my whatever po woke political views, right? Like it's interesting because I'm Christian, even though Christians were complicit in the residential schools, which caused harm to indigenous people. Because I'm religious and as spiritual, I can connect with a lot of indigenous clients who are also very spiritual, right? They might not identify as religious and they might not even be Christian, but even just having that framework, it enables me to work with them on a level that someone who doesn't have any spirituality can't, right? And it's a weird thing, right? Because secularism and generally speaking, the more secular and the more left-leaning you are, the more anti-spirituality you are. But that's also a huge part of indigenous culture, right? So you see people who are, yeah, they're very anti-religion generally, but when it comes to indigenous, they're very pro. Like I remember when I was in when doing my program, like in the indigenous class, we were like we did like a we did like the smudging thing, and we were like doing like a prayer as a group, and me and my friend who are Christian are like, we're not against it. We're like, okay, cool. Like, we're not like, oh, this is like against our religion or something. But we're like, it's interesting how that's allowed, right? How we're allowed to, kind of mix religion and the state, I guess, because it's a publicly funded institution, right? In certain contexts.
There's also kind of a contradiction in what is generally called the left, when they support these marginalized communities, but when you go and you honestly meet with these marginalized communities, they have more conservative. They're just more conservative by definition. They are conserving tradition. They are more into tradition. They're more wary of the impersonalization of the, yeah, I guess professionalization and bureaucratization and that kind of organization that is at the heart of the left, this kind of centralizing, structuralizing, putting people into these little different boxes. And when I was at Evergreen, right when that woke stuff was just like kind of still strange to me, I'm like, well, how are these, you guys are all kind of like, there's this intersectional banner and you're all fighting for each other, but what happens when the indigenous people or the native people or the Native Americans don't want to deny the reality of sex, because so much of their culture is about sex. And then this trans stuff wants to completely erode sex. So how are you guys going to get along? So you're helping each other right now to win against Whitey, but your values don't actually align beyond this one kind of like getting your way right now, you know, and we'll kind of scratch back system that somebody's going to get scratched a little too hard sometime, at some
It's a
point.
good point, and that was actually the that kind of specific hypocrisy was the one that led me to the conflict with my classmate. But before I mention that, I just wanted to quickly mention how, like you said, like a lot of Indigenous people are very conservative, especially if they're more rural, right? Generally speaking, rural people are more conservative than urban people. But the media, especially like the Canadian media, always focuses on the nations that are more, you know, left leaning or anti-energy sector, they'll always focus on the Wet'suwet'en who will not allow, you know, the pipeline to go through their land. Meanwhile, there's tons of other Indigenous nations like the Xkuapem and other groups which have allowed those to go through their land, and they're using that to energize their economies and create jobs and build schools and do all these amazing things which you don't see on the TV. Like I only learned that because one of my classmates was from one of those nations, and she's like not super pro energy, but she at least was honest. She's like, yeah, I don't know how I feel about it, but we signed deals to let them build through our land, and it's really benefiting our nation, right? She was just honest about it.
Were you smearing the media as biased just now? Is that what I picked up?
But
Canadian media of all things?
yeah, they're definitely pro, I don't know, more left leaning in Canada, I think. I don't think that's a controversial statement. But what was I going to say? Oh yeah, so the hypocrisy about, you know, picking and choosing Indigenous beliefs or having beliefs that contradict them, but also saying you promote Indigenous people. The discussion came from the context of like anti-oppressive practice. I'm not sure if you've heard this term, but anti-oppressive practice is like how can we work in pe with people in a way where we're not oppressing them, right?
Okay. All right.
So anti-oppressive is kind of like anti-racist. It doesn't really make sense. It's like obviously we're all don't want to be racist. Obviously, why do we need to create a term, right? Whenever someone has to create a term to for something that's obvious, then you know something is up. But my teacher, he was you know, he made us read an article on like kind of pro this worldview and then anti, and the anti this worldview was saying, well, who gets to decide what's anti-oppressive, right? What if there's disagreement about that, right? And so I presented that class because it was a presentation, a discussion about this woman, Faye Blaney, who's an Indigenous woman from the Downtown East Side. So I'm not sure how much you're familiar with the Downtown East Side, but it's the poorest postal code in Canada, and there's high, you know, highest rates of HIV/AIDS per like capita in North
Wow,
America
okay,
because of
really?
the, you know, drug use and the needles and stuff. And so it's just very concentrated, right? A lot of social housing and just general disorder and drug dealing and open air, you know, stuff. So, anyways, this lady from the Indigenous community, Faye Blaney, she was an advocate for women who were in the Downtown East Side who were being sexually exploited. She started the March for the Missing Women, right? Because there was a serial killer, Robert Picton. He killed a lot of these women who were, you know, in prostitution. And basically the police ignored it because people go missing all the time down there. So they're like, ah, it's fine. They just probably, you know, they probably just moved, right, or something. And anyways, he ended up killing like many, many of these women and like feeding them to the pigs on his farm. It was a horrific situation. And so as a result of that, it just, you know, gave more energy to like, we need to we need to recognize that there's a problem here. There's people being abused and exploited. And so Faye Blaney started that march, and now it's a huge thing, right? And the whole missing and murdered Indigenous women. It's a bit, became a national thing. But eventually they booted her off because she wasn't pro sex work. She was saying, these people are being exploited. They're all drug users. They're doing this to survive. So in a sense, they are choosing to sell their bodies to survive, but this isn't empowering. And our Indigenous culture, didn't have prostitution, right? This is something that only came after Europeans. So this isn't, basically she was saying this is, that prostitution is oppressive to my people, my Indigenous sisters. And so I presented that in the class, right? I knew that it would be controversial because I knew that most people there are probably pro sex work, but oh yeah, my classmate, she was not having it. She was, and then she also connected that to this, there's a shelter in Vancouver called the Women's Rape Relief, and they won't allow trans men in there. They eventually lost government funding because of that. She's like, oh, is this Faye Blaney person attached to this? So I didn't even know, but like she was attaching it to all these other people. And so that was basically when we had our falling out because she was like, oh, well, you're part of the, you're a TERF and a SWERF and a SMURF and all these things.
Oh, yeah,
And
okay.
then
So she wants
friendship
women to be
over.
selling their bodies.
Yeah, so the pro-sex work argument is that women can do whatever they want with their bodies. If a woman is poor and she, at a go work at McDonald's, you can make $6 an hour. But if she can make more money selling her body and providing for herself and her family, then to deny her that is like misogynistic, or it's denying her autonomy and agency and choice.
It'd be interesting to see if the person that you're describing ends up working with prostitutes or with getting social services to, or even doing counseling with prostitutes, and if that would change her point of view.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, she's not foreign to that. There are like sex work advocacy groups, right? So there are people who do that work who are saying this, we want to do this. This isn't a bad thing. Oftentimes, though, a lot of them are people who are, they have worked their way up to the point where they're maybe like managing other people, or they have another job and they do that as an additional job. So it's less of the people who are on the bottom rung. There's tiers, right? There's like the survival at the bottom, and then there's kind of like the doesn't have many other options, maybe could do something else, but they just don't have a lot of options. That's like the bottom 50%. And then the top 50, there's like, maybe 80% who are just doing it because they can make more money. And the higher up you go, the more choice you have over who you work with, and you can enforce more guidelines about what they can and cannot do. So the higher you go up, the more vocal the advocacy is, essentially, to say, I want to do this, because they have less of the bad and they make more money because they can charge more, right? Because they're, yeah.
There is a yeah, there is a class analysis that can be applied to a lot of the feminist movement, specifically how sometimes they're fighting, how it's just not one movement because there are different interest groups in the category of woman, and the higher class women want, access to abortions, but then access to later on marriage, and then access to, like, different sorts of resources, whereas lower class women were probably better served by different forms of social enforcement, and then social welfare, let's say, not just resources from the state to help them, but also a state of being in society that would help them, and that state of being would probably not be the same, or not be as it wouldn't be the same as, like, the liberal or the progressive woman who wants to just do whatever she want, and doesn't have to worry about or doesn't have to well is more worried about not getting what she wants than being in a situation where her wants are being drastically mismanaged by a society that kind of treats her like trash. Right. Or men that treat her like trash.
Yeah, there's, as you go up in income or class, the more choice you have generally. right? And the more of a time and platform you have to advocate for those things, right? For the women who are coming from the bottom, survival, you know, they're doing it just to get by and to get drugs because, you know, they don't have any other way of, I mean, they could, but usually addicted, and it's hard. There's not many people advocating for those people, right? Because most of those women die on the streets, right? They don't make it out. So they don't, you know, there's this one woman, Trish Bapty, when she was in the downtown east side doing that work, and she got out, and so now she's an advocate, but that is a very rare exception. And it's really brutal listening to her stories because it's quite violent, right? But even though she got out and she's talking, she doesn't really have a platform, right? She doesn't have power in society, right? She's just another woman who got out, right? Whereas, you know, if you have money and resources and social connections and your narrative is pro whatever the most progressive narrative is, then you're going to get supported.
It's really, yeah, it is really interesting, just bringing up like women's prisons and how the trans narrative that works within elite progressive climate of, you know, do whatever you want, express how you want. We're gonna, it's polite to just accept your identity as you want to identify. And somebody just wrote on one of my previous videos, pardon the term, that they said you could either be nice or a piece of shit. So why would you just not be a piece of shit and just call people how you want them to, how they want to be called? You know, this man's a she now. So when it's really simplistic, it's just be nice, be kind, go along with the thing. But when you actually look at the way that a way of thinking, like we're just going to allow you to just assume whatever your gender is, and we're going to go along with that because we're nice. It's the nice thing to do to put serial rapists into the women's prisons, right? It's the nice thing to do to give kids irreversible surgeries and hormonal endocrine disruptors, because it's the nice thing to do. It's like, well, what about all the downstream effects of niceness? And this might go back to what you something that changed in you about conservatism or reading about conservatives, whereas we go from, I mean, a lot of us young people who grew up in the last 20, 30 years, going to the schools that we've gone to, we assume that liberal is the nice thing. You're open-minded, and you know more. And the conservative's kind of closed-minded and closed-hearted. But you see, once you start to open it up, you see like conservatives just like kind of longer-term thinking. In a way, or it can be, it is just as compassionate, but it's on a longer scale. It's like it's kind of being more respectful to the life cycle or to humanity in general, or in toto, rather than the progressive individual who's thinking about the immediate desire and the immediate needs of somebody.
Yeah. I think I definitely was guilty of that. I remember there was when I was going to my undergrad, there was a guy in our the Christian club I went to who was the token conservative in our group. I mean, maybe there was other conservatives, but he was the vocal one. And he was such a troll. And I remember just thinking like, ah, oh, this guy's such a troll. He's always trolling everybody. But now looking back, I kind of feel bad for him because I realized he was always getting ganged up upon. I mean, it's because, you know, he wanted to share his views. And I realized he probably just did that because it was easier to like take on that persona of the heel just to emotionally survive, right? When you're constantly being like belittled and told that you're, you know, bad or that you don't care. I think that's the hardest part about having, whether you're conservative or anything, just having views that maybe aren't, you know, mainstream or viewed as nice is that people assume that you're a bad person or they assume that you're I don't know what they assume, but they assume that something's wrong with you or you're morally deficient or something. Like I had a colleague who you know, he was we had a great rapport and like, you know, we'd laugh and just was one of my favorite like people to chat to in between session and stuff. We'd share clients and refer clients to each other. And then when he found out that I, you know, worked with gender dysphoria, but from a more gender critical perspective where I, you know, I helped, you know, people to like wait and like let's explore, right? Like to parents, I would advise them like, hey, like the watchful waiting is, you know, it's not a bad thing, right? This is what was always done with youth was to say, hey, let's wait, you know, let's not jump into social transition because social transition is a big deal, right? And so So I guess I don't know what he found out about what I do, but once he found out that I wasn't, I don't know, aligned with whatever he thought was virtuous, he just like completely cut me off. And he was like very upset. And like, he didn't even give me a chance to defend myself. Like, he's like, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. And I'm like, okay, like I respected that and I didn't, say anything and haven't talked to him since. But it was just such an about change, similar with the friend from university, right? It's like, oh, like you think this, and then there's all these assumptions. It reminds me when I was like going through training to become a police officer, because I worked in the jail and in various roles with the police, but not as a police officer. And they said, like, when you're wearing the uniform, people just see you as a badge. They don't see you as a person, right? So that's why they'll often like respond so hatefully, because they just, however they feel about the police is how they feel about you. And that's what I think it is, right? They what however they feel about conservatives, or however they feel about whatever group they've lumped you into in their brain, now you're one of those groups, and it's just very tribalistic. It's very sad.
So, bringing up the gender topic, and not just specifically that, but what is the impact of the progressive assumptions on your profession right now, and how do you navigate those?
I think the result is that people are either they don't want to work with gender, right? Like I've heard that from clients who have found me, is that they've tried to work with people, or they'll say like, I don't work with gender, right? And so I think there's a fear, or there's a lack of knowledge. It could be a fear or a lack of knowledge, right? Or there's they take the gender affirming approach, which isn't really therapy. It's really just agreeing with someone, right, and helping them get resources, right? So in social work, that's actually a function of social work, right, is resource referral. So, oh, hey, you're transgender, okay, well, maybe I can help you get connected with an endocrinologist or primary care or something like that, right? So, and that's a if someone wants services and you can help them get those services, then great, right? But that's not really therapy, right?
No, it's not. Can we pause on that for a second? If social work, I guess social work then is a arm of the state. If what it does is it acts as a you said a resource referral. So whatever the state values, that's what the I don't know, there's just something there where you're a functionary of the state. So you're plugging people into the system, and the system is using you to plug people into it. I'm just
Basically.
kind of like at this point in my career or in my thought life, like I'm really wary of Cthulhu of the state. And so just like kind of thinking of social work as you're not actually doing social work. Your job isn't to help society so much as help the state help society, or help the state mold society in its own image by plugging it into resources that the state finds value in, right?
Well, I don't think that there's inherent anything. I don't see anything inherently wrong with referring people to resources. It's mostly because social workers, most of the time, social workers like in a hospital or who aren't doing like one-to-one work like I'm doing, are mostly case managers, right? Which means that you don't see the person regularly, right? You might see them like once a month, or maybe you just see them once and then you just have like an hour meeting with them, you figure out what they need, and then you help them connect them with what they need to get connected to. So there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is that social work is supposed to, social workers are only supposed to engage in evidence-based practices. And I don't think there's any specific guidelines in our ethics that we can only refer people to evidence-based practices, but you'd think that it would follow. You'd think that if we ourselves can only practice evidence-based, as in things that have been verified by science, then we probably shouldn't refer someone to like Reiki or something like that, right? I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with Reiki, but I don't think there's any studies necessarily showing that Reiki works. Maybe there is, I don't know. For those who don't know, Reiki's energy healing. But that's the problem, right? Is that there is no evidence-based care model for transgender, because there's no model, right? Even if you don't do gender affirming, right? Like gender affirming, first of all, it's not even therapy, right? It's just a
It's
medical
a resource
system,
referral.
right? Yeah, it's a medical resources that you can get, right? Hormones or whatever. But the evidence Like the evidence that that produces good outcomes is not of good quality, is the general consensus, which isn't really a standard of care. It's just this, we're not really sure if this actually works. So that's why generally we should say, let's be cautious and slow and wait, give people time to develop normally to adulthood. And then if they're still having a lot of dysphoria, then this is an option to treat that by, you know, changing some of their secondary sex characteristics or primary sex characteristics to reduce some of that distress. It's a medical treatment, it's a strategy, but you know, medicine generally is always supposed to start with the least intervention possible, right? Like if you go to the doctor and you have issues, they'll usually try and get you to like, you know, exercise or have a diet before opening you up, right? So evidence-based care is, you know, it's not really talked about a lot, but technically that's what we're supposed to be sticking to as social workers.
What's the evidence basis for cognitive behavioral therapy then?
There's a lot of good support for CBT. I mean, it's been around since I think the 50s or maybe even longer. And generally speaking, CBT has good results for depression, anxiety, and OCD. There's also CBT-based therapies for trauma, like CPD and exposure, prolonged exposure therapy, PET. So yeah, CBT probably has the most evidence behind it of anyone, just because it's been around the longest, and there's been it's created so many spin-off therapies like DBT, ACT therapy. There's so many second and third wave CB like cognitive behavioral
Okay,
therapies.
yeah. It's like
So
the
yeah.
acronym that launched 1,000 acronyms.
Basically,
Gotta
yeah.
love it. Gotta love those acronyms. So if I had anxiety, what would I do cognitively to my behavioral situation to achieve therapeutic results?
Depends on the modality, but if it was from a CBT perspective, exposure therapy, right? So exposure therapy is basically exposing yourself to the feared situation to build up tolerance. So the more you avoid something, the more your anxiety increases around that thing, right? So if you have social anxiety, for example, the more you seclude yourself, the more your social anxiety will increase. Partly because you're not getting exposed to that, so you're not building up a tolerance to being around people, but partly because you're also losing the skills and abilities to have conversations, which makes you also more nervous and anxious about doing that, right? So part of it's exposure, that's a big piece. And then the second part is the cognitive part of like, what are your fears? What do you think is going to happen? Oh, I think everyone's going to laugh at me. Well, helping people to check that with facts, like what, when have people laughed at you? Or what was the likelihood that someone's going to laugh at you and never want to be friends with you? Or doing a behavioral experiment, like, okay, go talk to someone and look at their facial expressions. Did they laugh at you? Did they smirk? Did they reject you? Did they ignore you? And then most people can, you know, they'll realize, or they may even know from the beginning, yeah, I know that it's not, I know my thoughts aren't realistic. That's just how I feel, right? So it comes back to, I guess, those four components for social anxiety: exposure therapy, helping them to change their thoughts, sometimes practicing conversations, or helping, giving them like practical tools, like what questions do you ask? Like, how do you know, what if you don't know what to say, or what if there's awkward silence? And then the final one is just relaxation techniques. So if you're feeling panicky and you're about to go in a situation, you're wanting to avoid it, but you know that if you avoid it, you're just going to get more anxious in the long term. How do you calm your nervous system down through like breathing techniques to be able to tolerate it for that moment?
There's this one cohort that, or there is a tendency of the younger generation, I guess people in their 20s, Gen Z, let's say, to be hyper-therapized. And I've met them, even detransitioners, they're still looking for a therapeutic fix. How do you recognize when therapy is just somebody's like, do people just like reach enough therapy? It's like, okay, you have to stop thinking about this. Like therapy is not the answer. Therapy is like not the answer.
Yeah.
Do you see that? And what are your thoughts on something beyond what's beyond therapy?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm definitely I think therapy can help people, but I don't think it's the answer. Research shows that no matter what therapeutic approach you take, basically all of them work. So it's not about special knowledge. It's not about special techniques. It's basically the relationship. It's having a relationship with someone who's supporting you, giving you some knowledge, some way of being that you believe is going to work. So partly it's
Okay.
placebo,
Yeah.
and supporting you to do that, accountability, community, and then you can sustain that. So there's no magic going on there, even though, each new modality that springs up, they claim that they're revolutionary. It's called the dodo bird effect, right? Everything works. But we also know that therapy, after a while, people usually return to their base set point happiness, right? That theory is that, like, no matter how, if you win the lottery or if you break your leg, no matter how happy or sad you get, you usually revert back to your whatever you were before after a period of time. So the only thing that really affects long term, they did in the grand study, was long term relationships. So, and I think that's essentially why most people, what counseling is doing for people mostly, it's a stopgap for community, for relationship that's just broken down in modern society.
Yeah, there's a aspect of therapists are like secular priests. They're confessional. They're the ones who, I guess, if you could probably push it a little bit further insofar as therapists or psychologists give speeches and sermons. They do kind of do the sermonizing. They kind of like say, this is how you be a good person. This is what. The one thing that's kind of missing, or when I talk to psychologists, psychotherapists, counselors, it's like, okay, well, what is a man, like, or what is mankind? Like, that's more the religious, like there's got to be some sort of religious certainty, or else there's a vague notion of happiness or health or homeostasis. Like, okay, what is it to be a good person? Is to you feel happy, or are you being a good person? I guess, how does religion inform or complete or extend your therapeutic theory on the theoretical side, rather, and maybe on the praxis side too?
I think it informs it in like, if I have a Christian client, I'll usually like try to access resources from the Bible and from, that prayer or whatever to help them, right? Because I think there's a lot there. And if someone isn't a Christian, then I won't talk about, Christianity or the Bible, but I might talk about things like purpose or meaning or things like that. It is very hard though, like, because without anything outside of you, without anything that has created everything, it's more just whatever meaning you can create for yourself, right? Which that doesn't seem to be as existentially satisfying to people, and it's very hard to do, right? How do you create your own meaning? I mean, people do it. There's happy atheists, right? Obviously, but I definitely am leaning more towards, I think, down the line, I might end up in a different career where I'm able to, use more spirituality and stuff like that, because I do find the secular counseling quite limiting in a lot of ways.
Yeah. And are you required to stay within the secular framework because of the way that you bill or whatever?
Well, I have to use, like I said, I have to use evidence-based techniques. So as long as
Okay.
I'm like, doing
So you
CBT or
can't
doing
just shout, "Jesus is the answer," and not have a paper backing you up, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a good point, right? Like I was mentioning with flexibility with Indigenous clients, like sometimes the work with I'm doing them, I wasn't necessarily CBT, right? Like a lot of like talk therapy is very vague, right? Like so you can't, like, is there limitations? I think the limitation is just the person, right? And what they're open to, right? Like if I have a Christian and I'm doing like Christian counseling, right? So
Okay.
maybe we might talk about God, and they're fine with that. They want to, right? They're
Yeah.
looking for a counselor who does that.
Yeah.
So I think as long as you're still doing something that resembles traditional therapy, you're probably fine. And your client
Okay.
wants it, right? You're not like imposing your own beliefs on them or trying to force
How
their
did
else on them.
God intrude into your life? Is this a lifelong, did you grow up in the
Yeah,
church?
I grew up in the church. My dad was like a pastor on and off.
Was like a pastor on and off. That's
Good. Yeah,
rich.
that's a weird way
That's a
to say it.
story.
He was a pastor at different points in time. He would work in construction, and then he was a pastor mostly before I was born. But there was a period when I was in my middle school years where he was a pastor again for a year or two.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I grew up with that, and then I kind of, during my middle school years, I was kind of acting not Christian like just partying, and I felt bad about it. Like I felt like there was a disconnect, like I was living a double life. And then at a certain point, I decided, okay, like I need to decide if I'm gonna like follow God or just abandon it and do my own thing. And so I decided, okay, this is what I want to do. So after that point, then it became more,
Can
I
I
made it more
ask
my own.
how you knew, or what convinced you to go one way rather than the other?
I don't think I ever had any doubt about the truth of like I never had any doubts about God or anything. It was more just like, do I want to limit myself and not enjoy, partying and what everyone else is doing, right? Like, I had a friend in university who, we were on the football team and he was like partying and stuff. And I was like, hey, like, I can't remember how he got around to it. I wasn't like trying to judge him or anything, but we were talking about it. And he's like, yeah, he's like, I think I just want to like put a pause on my faith right now and just enjoy university and then kind of like pick it up again later kind of thing. So I think if I didn't follow God, that would probably be more it. Like I still believe in God, but I'm just going to put a pause on that right for now.
Like what did
But you're asking like
wasn't
what made me choose it, I guess. What made me like decide I'm going to go this way? I think that well, there was a moment that was pretty impactful. My dad invited me and my brother to a conference called Promise Keepers. Promise Keepers is like a men's, I don't know if you heard of it, but it's
Yeah,
like
I
a
remember
men.
that. I remember that. That's still around?
I don't know. It was when I was that age. I looked at the website. I think they still do some stuff in the States, but yeah, that was pretty meaningful. Like there was a day long and they had different speakers but the most meaningful thing for me was they do like have opportunity for fathers to bless the sons. And my dad did that for me, and I don't even remember what he said, but I just remember like the feeling and the look in his eyes, and it was very powerful. And I remember someone coming up to me after and being like, "Whoa, like that was like a kingly anointing. Like he was even blown away about what my dad said." And so I think that was like, okay, I'm gonna do this. And then I think also that was the first time when I started to really just enjoy God, like. I would like put on worship CDs and just lie in bed and like just like sing for like hours and just be crying, like just enjoy, like feeling God's love washing over me. So I think it was the first time where it was more, I was experiencing God rather than just like going to Sunday school and like eating cookies and juice after church, right? Like it was actually like, wow, like God is amazing. Like he loves me so much. Just, I've never felt this joy. This is so wonderful. This is so, I don't know. Yeah, good.
Having that experience, I guess, and then working in count is th how does that fit into your life choices with regard to helping other people?
Being a Christian?
Or experiencing the joy of the Lord, to use a Christian term.
I don't know. Like, I bounced around with my career. I never started with counseling. I think I was like, oh man, I had so many ideas. I won't go through them all, but I changed my mind multiple times about what I wanted to do. It was more interest-based, less like of like a calling or a vocation. And even counseling, it didn't feel really called to it, but it felt like, okay, this could be a good option. And then I did the one-to-one youth work and I was like, oh, I really like this. I'm gonna do something like this.
What's one-to-one youth work? What kind of stuff were you doing then?
Like meeting up with, I was a transition worker, so I was helping Indigenous youth transition from like high school to adulthood. Some of them were still living with their parents, some of them were in foster care, but all of them had like social worker involvement, and they might be, street entrenched, which means like they skip school a lot and hang out on the street and stuff. So I would try to meet up with them and like help them like get jobs, get housing, budget, very like life skills stuff, things like that.
And
Sorry, I
what
forgot
was
what.
it about that? Yeah, what was it about that that turned, like put
Made
you
me, yeah.
forward then? Just like the way that you fit into people, the way that
I think it's
people
just
made
being
you
able
feel,
to,
or?
I think it's just building a relationship with somebody. Like, I love the fact that, like, I had a caseload of, like, maybe, like, 15, 12 to 15 youth, and I would meet them, each one of them, every week for an hour or two, sometimes more if, like, we had to, like, do something bigger. But I just loved like getting to know them, talking to them, like helping them, like journeying with them through life essentially. And sometimes we get to do fun stuff too, right? Like one summer I did a summer program for a bunch of these youth, and like we went out and like did camping and all this cool stuff. So I just like connecting with people. I think that's the enjoyable part of it for me.
And you indicated that you might end up doing something else later on. But at least
Yeah,
it'll still be with people, you think?
I definitely feel called to be a pastor. I just don't know like about what the timing of what that might look like. So I'm
How old are
still
you now, if I may ask?
34.
34. Okay. You look 27. You have my kind of face, I guess.
People think I'm younger than I am because I've got a baby face and I don't have a beard. I grew a beard for grad school because I was like, I need to look more mature, but it was terrible beard. It was terrible.
Terrible beards. My life with a terrible beard. Pastoring is a whole other can of worms. There's an aspect of this that of my job here that is counselor, and I was very wary of going like anything pseudo pastoral, like with setting up, like trying to set up my own little parish, I guess, internet parish by having like these enclosed pay-per-view kind of content where you kind of say I'm kind of like a person, and there's an aspect to the work insofar as it's like the influencer kind of stuff where you're a public intellectual, you're some sort of counselor plus, or some sort of like leader of a community. Like there's something about being a leader of a community, especially online, that I don't trust. Like in person would probably be there's more safe. Well, I guess it's always danger of a cult of personality and stuff, but if you're working with a denomination and you're actually trained in this stuff, a lot of though cults keep on happening, a lot of the entrenched established denominations have foreseen and seen this happen enough that they have tools and guidelines to keep this from happening. They have different structures, with boards of trustees and stuff like that. Have you ever worked, or what is your perception of the change from individual one-on-one counselor to somebody like a pastor in a church? Is that what you were thinking, or like more like a chaplain work where are you kind of like in an institution doing pastoral type care?
Good question. Can I put a pause on that? I realized I forgot to lock the door. So
Oh
I,
no.
is it okay if I
Yeah, I
quickly
mean, you're in
change it?
Canada, right? A bear's gonna pop through any time.
Just a second.
Yeah, for sure.
I work out in my son's room, and sometimes when he comes home from school, I'll be in a session. I forget to lock the door, and he just like pops in the room. He's like, "Where's my toy?" I'm like, "Oh my God."
How old's your son?
He's 5. He's in kindergarten.
Is he your first and only?
First, we have another one who's almost a year old now. So
Wow. Okay.
We can talk about that, but your question about pastoring, yeah, definitely thinking more of like, traditional pastor of a church or something like that. I never wanted to be a pastor. I always thought, oh, that sounds like the worst job ever. I never want to do that. But I think what's changed in me is general disillusionment with the ability of counseling to like help society. Like I think it can help individuals for a set period of time while they're doing the counseling. But seeing how like the societal need for meaning and purpose in community is so great and counseling can't do that. And I like connecting with people, but ultimately I want to help people. Like if I'm just connecting with people but I'm not helping them, then what's the point? And like I said, I think I can help people doing this, but I think that I can help more people in doing that. So I think that's
How?
part of it.
How?
How? I think like the church is a community, right? So that provides a community for people to take part in. And then I guess in like the teaching aspect of it is helping people to, I don't know, align themselves with, how God has made them and how God has gifted them. And I think because of my experience with in university and through counseling, I think it gives me a, I think I have a good like idea of a lot of the things that people are struggling with in society, and also a lot of doctrines that have infiltrated the church that are that are not from the Bible and that are causing a lot of damage in the church. And also just the gospel, right? I think that, you know, there is a social aspect to the church that is beneficial, right? Even if there's no, if it's not orthodox, right? Like a Unitarian Canadian church is not orthodox, and I think there's some benefit to that. But ultimately, to me, the power of the church is the gospel, right? Is the good news. So,
What's the essence
yeah.
of that good news to you?
The gospel is essentially, you know, that Jesus came and he died on the cross for us so that we could be saved from our sin and we could have a relationship with God in this life and forever. And to me, that brings me a lot of joy, and it's changed my life. And I think that's what brings transformation to people's lives is knowing that God loves them enough to die for them, that everything they've done you know, if they accept God's grace, is thrown into the bottom of the sea. They don't have to, you know, they don't have to ruminate on all of the things they've done bad. They don't have to, you know, constantly feel condemned.
So it's Christ behavioral therapy then.
CHBT. I guess so. I mean, it's not therapy. I mean, I think there's an element of counseling. You know, I don't know if you've heard of the biblical counseling movement or the nuthetic counseling. It's essentially like counseling, but with biblical principles. And I think that's great. I think that ideally, you know, we all give each other counsel. You know, we all can be counselors for each other. And I think the professionalization of counseling has really done damage to community and our ability to rely on one another for counseling. And I think biblical counseling has the other benefit that it's not like, oh, I'm telling you because I know better than you. It's like, hey, let's look at what this book says. You know, apparently God wrote it, so he probably knows how humans work, and let's see what it says, right? So it's not so there's no chance of me being like arrogant or like, oh, I have the knowledge. It's like, I don't have any right to say, you know, what anything about you. But if you profess to follow God, then this book can say what you can and can't do. So let's look at it together and let's see what it says.
Is there a particular passage in the Bible that's been of particular import for you in the last few years?
I mean, there's a lot. One that I've been reflecting a lot in the past year or so is Psalm 16. And it talks about how like God is our inheritance. And the Lord is, it says the Lord is my chosen portion and my cup. So it's like, I'm choosing God. It says those who run after other God, the sorrows of those who run after other gods will multiply. So if people, when people try to look for pleasure and joy outside of God, it increases their sorrows. But it says that it ends with, in your presence is the fullness of joy, at your right hand, pleasure forevermore. So I really like that verse because I think it brings me back to, you know, the joy of being with God and enjoying God for himself, not for any other external reasons. And I think the draw, right? Is that like, is love. Like why do people work, you know, so hard? Is it so they can make money, or is it so that they can, you know, build a life for themselves and have love, you know, give love and receive love? So, yeah, Psalm 16 has been really, I come back to that one a lot. I pray it a lot when I'm walking and thinking and stuff.
How long you been married?
10 years this year.
10 years.
We dated for 6 years
Congratulations.
before that, so
Oh wow, okay. So
it's
she's taken up almost half your life right now then. Wait, if you're 34, 60, you met her when you were 18?
We met in
Huh?
first year of university.
Oh wow, okay. And you've been steady since then. Wow. How is being a husband, and how does your faith inform you, or mold you, or shape you, or guide you in that role in the world?
I think that I often think about like Jesus. Like there's this verse where it says Jesus, he did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped. So the Orthodox Christian teaching is that Jesus is God, right? But it says he did not account that Equality was got something to be grasped or held on to, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant. So I think of that a lot, is that like my role as a husband is to be like that, like to empty myself and to serve my family, you know, lay my life down for my family, and you know, be an example to my son, and be there for my wife, and I guess the heart of it is service. Yeah.
And do you have any desire to, being a pastor comes with like sermonizing. Do you have any desire to, do you write? Do you articulate your thoughts in one way or another?
Yeah, I have a blog on my website. I mean, I don't write on it a lot, but I've written some articles on there. I've done some talks and workshops at church, local churches and universities and stuff.
What's the
So,
content of these
I
generally?
do various topics. I've talked about I've talked about sexuality, I've talked about gender, I've talked about I guess like more Christian topics, just like, you know, the Holy Spirit or you know, living prayer, like so various different topics. Yeah, I really enjoy that. I really enjoy teaching and engaging people.
What is the, from your point of view, and this might be a much bigger question that you weren't prepared to be asked, but what does the Bible say about gender? What does it tell us about
Yeah.
gender?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by gender, right? Like, if we take gender to mean synonymous with sex, is that what you mean? Is that how you're using gender? Like,
You can use it however you want to.
okay. So I can answer your question how I want to then.
Yeah, you can.
I think that the Bible, I think the word gender has become too broad. I think before it just used to mean sex. So I think. So in terms of sex, I'll answer both. So in terms of sex, you know, God, I think God created two sexes, like men and women. And then in terms of gender, that's more like your expression, right? Like how do you express that in terms of your dress and your role, right? How you relate to other men and women. And I think, you know, there is stuff in the Bible about, you know, prohibitions about cross-dressing and stuff like that. So I think there is some emphasis in the Bible about conforming to gender norms, right? That men, you know, shouldn't dress like women or women like men. But I think there's also some flexibility in that that is just like more that we realize like it's more about I yeah, that's a really interesting question. I've thought about this a lot because, you know, before, you know, my mom went to Bible college at a time when like women weren't even allowed to wear jeans, right? They had to wear dresses, and she was a rebel. She would wear jeans under her dress. But which we all think is silly now, right? But that was basically their wh why they were saying that was they were saying, okay, well, the Bible says, you know, we shouldn't, you know, there should be a separation of gender norms. So I haven't done a lot of honestly, I haven't done a lot of research and study on what the Bible says specifically about gender expression. But I think when it comes to the sex part, the biological part, it's you know, there's two men and women. Yeah.
Why?
Why does the Bible say that, or why do
Well, I
I?
mean, if the Bible's the book of answers, why did God create us as man and woman? Is
Oh,
there a spiritual reality
why
to
did
it?
he create us as men and women?
Because I know I've spoken with Catholics about this, and they have an answer about God's expression of himself through man and through woman, and how there's a sacred aspect to sex that teaches us about God's love. You know, basically there's
Yeah.
that kind of tack to it. I'm wondering if that has any traction for you, or if you've meditated on that. I just got married myself,
Oh,
and
nice.
I
Congratulations.
well, thank you. I see her walking around. I say, oh, that's a woman. She's so different from me. She plugs into the world differently than me. She's
Yeah.
teaching me something, and I'm different than her, and our differences are complementary, but they are profoundly different.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we're both human.
Yeah.
But she's a woman, I'm a man. There's big differences there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I've often wondered that myself. I think part of it is for us to to learn humility, and to learn the way of love, right? Which is self-sacrificial love, I guess. Because when you join yourself to somebody else and they're different from you, you have to, if you just insist on your own way all the time, you can be constantly fighting, right? You have to lay down sometimes your own needs and wants for that other person. I think like in today's culture, like emphasis is a lot on like happiness, right? Kind of like you were saying. But the Bible never says that God made us so that we could be happy. I think he wants us to be happy, but that wasn't his primary aim in making us. His primary aim in making us was to be holy, which basically means to be like him, right? And be in relationship with him. In marriage, it's basically like someone used the analogy, it's like someone put in front of you like a full-length mirror. Like marriage shows you your flaws. It shows you where you need to work on yourself, right? So I think partly it's a vehicle for becoming more like God, more loving. And so I think there's that practical aspect, but I think the other aspect is just joy, right? Like God created us to enjoy him, and he created us to enjoy the world, and he created us to enjoy relationships. And obviously there's so much joy in being in a relationship with someone where you're intimate, right? Mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually. There's a deep joy in that. And there's a partnership of working together. Like, we can accomplish so much more than what we can. Also, to propagate the earth, right? There's so many angles to it, right? It's such a deep question, which you could look at from so many ways, but
What about fatherhood?
yeah.
How has that changed you?
It's definitely like made me more patient, I think, because I've had to be more patient. It's given me a lot more structure too. Like I always thrive on structure, but I feel like before I had kids, I could kind of afford to stay up late. I could afford to like watch a bit more TV, read a bit more articles, waste time essentially. But with kids, when they wake up at like 5 a.m., you got to get up when they get up. So I think that actually disciplined me a lot to like, okay, I can actually go to bed earlier and actually like it more because I'm more productive and I end up doing things that I value more, right? Like, I don't know if you've ever heard this, but when I was a kid, my parents used to say nothing good ever happens after midnight. I feel like for me at least, because of the way that I tick, nothing really productive for me happens after like 10:30. Some people are different, some people are night owls, but I'm a morning person, so after 10:30, whatever I'm doing is probably wasting time. So,
And
yeah.
that's what you're, well, that's what fatherhood is really drilled into you.
Well, it's one of the things, like, yeah, patience, giving me more structure in my life. I think also like just play, like kids are so playful and joyful and they're so like in the moment. I think that's helped me because I can be very in my head, right? I love reading books. I'm like always reading a book, listening to a podcast, thinking. And sometimes I can get like quite like, daydreamy and lost in thought. Like one time when I was in grade 5, I was daydreaming and I accidentally called the teacher mom. It was a man. And so it was very embarrassed. But I've always been like
Wow,
that. So
you remember that from 30 years ago,
I was embarrassed because yeah, it was like everyone laughed. But yeah, like I think it's grounding. It's grounding to have kids. They're very in the moment, right? They're like my son's 5, so he might be thinking of like 1 week in advance at this point. He's not really thinking beyond
But he
the next
remembers
couple of days.
everything from a week ago.
Yeah. Well, he remembers things from even longer than a week ago, but he doesn't always talk about them, but he'll remember things from like, yeah, quite a while ago, which is, I was like, wow, you remember that? So, yeah.
So aside from this, your discontent, broadly speaking, with the ends and aims of secular counseling, what is your critique of the current profession right now, and as it is, as it stands now?
That's a good question. I think my critique would be, I guess, like a, I don't know if it's an arrogance or like a presumption that like people need us. They need counselors, right? Like, I think most counselors would acknowledge that not everyone needs counseling and not all the time. But I feel like when you become a counselor and when you help people, and it can make you feel like, oh, like we're indispensable to society, or like, because I think that there's this general trend of like, you know, there's not enough mental health support. There's not enough mental health support. Like, if only we had enough counselors and enough affordable counseling, then we'd be fine, which I don't think is true, right? So I think that I guess my critique of the general field is just that we maybe it's not of individual counselors, but maybe it's about how we as society, or how the government views the mental health system as like a bunch of individual counselors, right? Like, I don't think that's the answer. I think that, you know, the societal fabric has broken down, community has broken down, people don't have meaning and purpose, and relationship is a part of that. And counseling is, you know, trying to fill that gap. And I think until we do build those other things, like, counselors do play an important role of giving people support and giving people tools. You know, sometimes it's just practical stuff, right? But I do think that, yeah, I think we sometimes can think, oh, like, we just need more counseling, or, you know, counseling is gonna, like, the reason people are depressed is because we don't have enough counseling, or something like that, which, yeah, I don't know if counselors actually think that. I think it's more of maybe like a, I
Yeah,
see it sometimes
social.
in articles, or out there in the ether.
You know, there's it's kind of off topic. It's just something you made me think of. It was I think it was from The Machiavellians by James Burnham, I think his name is. And it might not even be from there. Let me just Machiavellians. Yeah, Burnham, James Burnham. But or somewhere in political philosophy where I was reading about the way that the church and the state used to work together, where the state or the kings, let's say, this is back in the Middle Ages, the kings would allow the state to have certain tax breaks. And that's not the way it worked, but like the church was didn't have to pay certain taxes or didn't have to do certain things, but it was because the church was acting in the role or was serving the state in a way by keeping a lot of the records and, kind of f fulfilling a lot of the bureaucratic aspects that the kings couldn't do at that time. And then as society reformed into more modern times and the state became central, and then the church became kind of, there was this so-called separation of church and state. For kind of a period, which isn't really true, but anyways, the church does what the church does, and the state does what the state does, but the state's not going to act in the form of a church, and the church is going to do whatever the church does over there with the human stuff and the God stuff, but the state's about the functioning society and the roads and the military and all that stuff. But as the state has expanded more and more, it's taking more and more aspects away from the church, or assuming unto itself functions that the church used to do: counseling, community building, charity work, all these other aspects. And now we see in the current iteration, in the last few years, where it's starting to have more and more of a doctrinal aspect to it, and more and more of a faith. The state has a faith that works within it, that it promulgates, with acceptance and diversity and equity and all these values of tolerance and so on and so forth. So it's like the church is now, the state is now becoming more and more like the church and the state again. Like there was this kind of like this kind of the splitting of these different aspects of the social order into these two kind of categories, and now it's being assumed into one whole thing. And counseling, at least in social work, it's supposed to fulfill the role of the priest in a certain respect, and maybe not explicitly and stuff, but it's supposed to, the state's trying to serve, so-called serve the humans there, and so is trying to provide human services to the humans. And so I just don't know if the state can have can do that without like having a positive vision. Or a specific political, ideological, kind of belief system that informs it. I don't know if you can actually help people without some form of belief, some form of transcendent ideology.
Yeah, and there's like existential therapy, right? There's a whole therapy which focuses on those kind of things, and it's secular, right? But yeah, I think what you're saying about social workers and counselors and psychologists as playing that role, and can the state play that role, and how the state even has its own kind of dogmas, right? So how do you have separation from church and state when the state becomes its own weird new religion, right? And I think that it makes me think about this book I read called Radical Help. It's by this woman who's a social worker in the UK, and she did some like kind of innovative programs where she would try to make changes to the social services in a way that would like make them more human, I think is the best way of kind of summarizing it. So for example, one of them was, you know, there were these families which were Which would were an sort of disproportionate drain on resources, right? So, you know, maybe a single mom with teen boys who are causing trouble in the neighborhood, so they'd always get like police calls to the neighborhood or ambulance or social workers. Basically, you know, these families they have a lot of resources sort of like pushed towards them, and maybe they have a lot of workers, right? Maybe there's like a team of workers around them, right? Psychologists and social workers and police and all these people, but it's not making any changes, right? Like they basically are responding to crises, and they come and see them for maybe once a month, and then they like tick a box or maybe refer them to something, but no one's living life with them, no one's helping them. They just have all, and it's costing so much money. So what she did was she hired a team of people, and she interviewed people from different fields, like social work, I think policing, nursing, like a few different ones, and eventually there was five people. And they basically were going to be assigned to that family. Like your only job is to help this family. And they committed to only doing 20% of their time to paperwork and 80% of their time FaceTime. So in most kind of like social work jobs, it's probably more like 50-50. So, or maybe even less. But so, and it really helped, right? Like basically, my theory is that the social support and the community that it gave the mom basically helped her to get out of her constant crisis to crisis spiral and actually be able to, you know, work towards finding a part-time job. Like if you're constantly living in crisis and survival mode, like you're not able to move forward, right? So it was the program was a success, and the, you know, in the calculations, the cost of that team was much less than what, you know, they would spend on that family over like, you know, years and years, and nothing have no benefit, tangible results, right? But it couldn't be implemented because the state, I think it's impossible for the state to implement programs that are truly human because of the bureaucratization and because of safetyism, right? There's so much liability. Like you can't, and when you're supporting friends or family or doing things, like sometimes you have to go after hours. Sometimes you have to do things that aren't like, you know, might be against policy, right? So there's so much red tape around like just being able to be there for someone and help someone life on life that it basically makes it impossible. And that's what people really need. So I think even just from that practical aspect, is that so many aspects of how the state works and functions are so bureaucratic and so obsessed with safety and liability avoidance, right? Is that it dehumanizes the service to the point where, you know, the person just comes in, checks in, oh, how are things going? Oh, do this and this and this, you know, give some advice. Oh, maybe add another referral, add another meeting that you have to go to where someone will ask you how your week goes and give you advice, right? It's just very watered down.
And do you feel like your work is closer to the human than the bureaucracy at this time?
I think so. Like I'm in private practice now. I used to work for the government, and in private practice, it's very, I have a lot of freedom, right? To, and people have freedom to work with me or not. So I think that humans, one aspect of their identity is freedom. And I think when people have freedom, it's, you're able to help them more, right? Because they're choosing something for themselves. They're paying for it, so they're more invested in it, right? When I work for the government, you'd have a lot of people no show, or they're not as invested in it because they're not paying it out of their own pocket. Or they're very entitled, right? The service ends and they get mad, right? It's like, well, we gave you the service. Like, weren't you happy that you at least got something at all, right? So there's a sense of entitlement. So I do think it's more human. But just for practical reasons, like it's not available to everyone, right? Because money, like I have to live. Not everyone can afford it, right? So I do offer sliding scales with some of my clients. They don't pay my full fee because I want to be able to see some people who can't pay the full fee. But yeah, it's not access, counseling is not accessible essentially to everybody. Yeah.
Well, David, thank you so much for reaching out and to for allowing me to probe your head, a role reversal, but it was actually a good back and forth that we had here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, and it was really good talking to you, and I always really appreciate your conversations,
Yeah.
and yeah,
Glad
it
to
was
hear.
great.
Do you have any big plans coming up? I know it's wintertime, but maybe you're going to go hunt a moose.
No big plans, but I am planning something for the school, for my son's school, which is a play club. So I've
Oh.
been wanting to do this for a while. It's basically just a space for kids to play outside with parents there, but not like interfering with the play. So it's like free play.
Yeah.
And so I'm meeting with some parents tonight to talk about
Oh, cool.
implementing it. So yeah,
Yeah.
so I'm excited
Kids need
about
more
that. Yeah.
play. Parks need to
Yes.
be stocked up on kids more.
100%.
They're just
100%.
too empty nowadays.
Yeah,
So,
totally.
good luck with that.
Awesome.
Thanks a lot, man.
All right.
I'll hit you up when this is published, all right?
Okay. Awesome. All right.
Have a good night.
Take care. Yeah.